You better come on in my kitchen. There's far to be raining out
door. Come over here, kid. Where's something? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic.
It's
and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, by country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. How are you doing this evening? Hope you had a great weekend. A little cooler than it was supposed to be, and that was just fine with me. That's not a complaint. Before I introduce tonight's guest, there's just a couple things I want to tell you. The first is just something really beautiful I saw in Sonoma County. And I thought, oh, here is one of the great reasons for being here, one of those moments. I was sitting in a window seat in Railroad Square, and I looked out, and for those few seconds before I realized where I was and when it was, it looked like it was snowing. And the whole sidewalk was covered with little pale pink or white and maybe both flower petals, and they were coming down so beautifully in the afternoon sun and the light breeze that you could just, you know, put your eyes just slightly out of focus. I was like, God, it is just so gorgeous here. So that was my Sonoma moment this week. The other thing is, got to say a little bit about Rialto Cinemas Lakeside. If you've been reading the Press Democrat or paying attention to the discussion, it looks like they are losing their lease after 10 years. And that theater has been such a good friend to both Mouthful and to KRCB in general, and then also to the community at large. We just talked very recently and had Evelyn Cheatham and Carrie Brown on talking about the event that was either last week or the week before the showing of that great film about the hidden story of Black Los Angeles. And they do things like that. They just give different theaters for a night and get films for community organizations. They just foster community in so many ways, and they don't play nonstop Hollywood blockbusters. And I tend not to go see Hollywood blockbusters, so I have a particular fondness for them and for the type of movies they show. I don't know if anything can be done, but there are people trying to do things, and there's two ways for you to look into it. If you're on Facebook, and I did this myself this afternoon, I thought, gosh, wonder if anybody started to save the Rialto yet. Typed it in on Facebook. There it was, already going strong. So you could go there. It's a good place. Best thing about Facebook is it's a really good way to get information really quickly and to communicate with people really quickly. The other thing you can do is go to Rialto Cinemas, I believe it is, yes, rialtocinemas.com, and click on Lakeside, and right there on the homepage for the Santa Rosa Theater is a list of five things you can do to help save the theater. I think it's a really integral part of Sonoma County and one of the things that makes us sort of distinct from every other suburban, you know, place in California. So check it out. And I just want to say to Kai and everybody else at Rialto Cinemas Lakeside, thank you for everything you've done and good luck. I am with you. On that note, we have some good Sonoma County friends in the studio. We are going to talk first with Steven Singer about Pizza Vino 707, a rebirth of West County Grill. And it's unique for a couple of reasons, and one of them is that there is also a wine collective, and two members of the wine collective will be joining us in the conversation, too. Welcome back to Mouthful.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yvette, I think this must be your third time.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so a quick history of Pizza Vino.
Oh, boy. The quick actual history is that in the absence of satisfactory options, I own that piece of real estate. I was very attracted to that piece of real estate in the first place. I think it's a great space. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of why I even ventured into it in the first place. I was always attracted to the centrality of it, and it was consistent with the overall commitment that I was making to being here in Sonoma County, in the Sebastopol in particular. So when we acquired the building, at the same time that I sort of felt I found a lot of opportunity there when West County did not work out, I also found a lot of obligation and not being able to find a proper alternative, somebody coming in there or who wanted the building, particularly in these difficult economic circumstances, I really faced a decision that it was time for me to try something else with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I think we're on to the right track. We definitely needed to be more consistent with the quality of whatever we put out, whether it was the quality of the hospitality or it was the quality of the experience sitting there, eating there in that pleasant big room. And that's kind of why we went the direction that I did. I engaged two really wonderful collaborators, John Clark and Gail Peary, who are the chef owners of the wonderful restaurant in San Francisco called Foreign Cinema, but they also have amazing experience really all over the world, kind of helping restaurants reboot, if you will, to use a contemporary term. And they've worked in Hong Kong, they've worked in Europe, they've worked in New York, and they've done a lot for a lot of different restaurants in California. So they're old friends of mine. I know them for a variety of reasons. They're fellow Berkeleyans. And I said I want a great wood-fired pizzeria, and that's what we've been trying to put into place. In the meantime, the space is a big space, and it has needs to be active, and that's where the notion for the Sonoma County Wine Collective that we have there kind of emerged as well.
Mm-hmm. And we should say, if you spent time at West County Grill, the structure to some degree is the same in that the bar is there.
Mm-hmm.
The bar is where it was before, and really it hasn't changed much. And I don't think there was a big reason for it to change.
No.
And the outside patio that you walk through to get to the bar, that's still there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the space that was sort of the raw bar.
Exactly.
And then you walk through that, and then you're in the dining room. And that counter seems really well used right now. Both times I've been there recently, I've sat at the counter, and I really like it.
Yeah, it is. It is the one nice thing about the restaurant is it's a long restaurant. It's 30 feet wide and 150 feet long, and we've got three counters, if you consider the bar, the marble counter, and then the counter faces the kitchen. And that central counter is not now actively or reliably seated during service and certainly during the day. And so it was a second kitchen, too. It used to be where the pastry station was. So we've really consolidated the kitchen activity in the main kitchen, and we somewhat decommissioned the kitchen there, and that's where the focus of the Wine Collective is for weekend tastings, and we have retail prospects available there, you know, anytime we're open. And I'm a importer of olive oils and vinegars.
Yes, I was hoping you would mention that.
And we also make those available because they're an important part of the restaurant's pantry. So it's kind of always been my approach to this thing that I do, which is have it all in one place. And in a particular way, what we've got going now is a closer realization of that. You know, all of the things that matter to me on the table are there.
Mm-hmm. And I just got to say, when it comes to the olive oils, you have San Giusto Arantanano. And that is just such a miraculously wonderful oil.
No, I agree with you.
Oh, I tasted it for the first time there where it was made. And it's great to have a source for it in Sebastopol. I want to hear more about the menu and about what's going on with Pizza Vino. However, I want to bring our other two guests in, and I want you to pour some wine, because it's just such a nice sound, and I know that everyone is probably eager for a glass. So, let's see. We have from Atascadero Creek, I hope I get this right, Bob Appleby, right?
Yes, that's right.
I did it right. Excellent. And we have Eric Sussman of both Radio Coteau and County Line. So glad you could join us, Eric.
Thank you.
So what are we going to pour first?
I think you should pour. Well, let's have a little dueling rosés here.
Okay. Okay, that sounds good.
Who's got the corkscrew?
we'll cut to the chase with mine quickly because it's my first screw top wine. Never has it come in more handy. I think it's not topped. Pour a little for you guys. Oh, the Swiss Army knife comes to the rescue.
All right.
Now, I have had this wine a couple times in the last couple weeks.
So have I.
Yeah, I bet you have the Baker Lane Rosé of Syrah, and it's really delightful. I love this wine.
Thank you very much. It's a little bit of an accident, this wine, only in as much as I'm a fan of rosé, but I hadn't intended to make any significant effort making it. And if you might remember the mind-blowing rain that we had in October that put a lot of late ripening grape growers in difficult position, we in anticipation of the rain, decided to pull a significant amount of fruit off the vine to try and open up the fruiting zone and the canopy so that after the rain we'd face less challenges. We didn't have fruit at that point that was particularly targeted where we like it to be taste-wise or ripeness-wise for red wine, but it was a beautiful level of ripeness for rosé, and so we made 350 cases of this barrel-fermented rosé of Syrah.
Well, it's got this beautiful acidity and this lovely finish of citrus that just, it refreshes your palate so beautifully right there at the end and just makes you want some more. I think this is a perfect luau wine.
Luau.
Okay, and so we have to finish these glasses so we can try Eric's. And this, of course, is County Line. It's gotten really popular over the last few years. Oh, what
good
a great sound.
Good car. So the County Line Rosé.
I'm going to make you pour it there.
It's got the right rosé sound.
This is coming from Champagne clones of Pinot Noir, grown in the Anderson Valley. And it's actually coming from a single vineyard source. It's Mary Elke's home ranch, which is just before you get into Philo. It's actually just outside of Boonville. And we're picking the grapes for this rosé when a lot of the sparkling wine houses are picking for their sparkling wine production.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually picked at lower sugars, higher acid. It's a Pinot Noir grape, but it doesn't color up like a Pinot Noir grape that you'd make a still wine out of. So when I say Champagne clone, it's actually, it was a selection that was pulled from Champagne, the region of Champagne, called the VVM clone. And so when we pick it, the clusters are, some of them are colored up and some of them are still a little bit rosy. And we take the grapes and we put the clusters into the press like we're going to press for a white wine. So we extract all the juice and then we take the juice and we put it in older Pinot Noir barrels and actually barrel ferment it. So it's almost like the base wine for a Brut Rosé, but we don't go through the secondary fermentation in the bottle.
Uh-huh. It's lovely.
It's really delicate.
Really delicate with that long rhubarb. finish at the end, which I'm very fond of that.
The first year we did this was actually in 2003. We had it down at the Ferry Plaza in San Francisco at the Hog Island Oyster Bar, and we had it on tap. So we were putting in kegs, but then we started to bottle it after that.
It's also really lovely. It's so nice to see wines like this, these really beautiful dry rosés coming from Sonoma County.
Thank you.
The idea of being able to make a wine that has, you know, this much flavor is due to our climate. You know, making wine in the right place is where so much of where we are now in winemaking in California. We're not being arbitrary anymore. Dealing with a lot of accumulated wisdom about where things grow well and how to make the right kind of wine. And talented winemakers like Eric really make a big difference as well.
Yeah, I agree. Long loved your wines, Eric. What's happening in the marketplace with wines like this? Have we gone over sort of the watershed? Are people over, oh, I don't like pink wines?
Rosé has made a huge comeback in the last 10 years.
And is it
10,
really
15 years ago,
sort of solidified now that it's...
Well, it's the styles have changed. Uh-huh. You know, 15 years ago, rosé was sweet jug wine and kind of looked down at by people that were really knowledgeable about wine. But as the winemakers have made drier and more food-friendly styles, it's made a big comeback in the... You know, seasonally, spring and summer.
Mm-hmm. And is that reflected in sales? Do these wines sell pretty well?
Eric's had a lot more experience with them. I do a lot of consulting for restaurants still, beyond my own involvement. And there's a period of the year in which you're kind of inundated with rosé choices, almost more than you think they're homes for. But the fact that there's so many that are here and they're from every part of the world, all over from California, but also from Spain and from... All parts of France and Italy, and that it reflects a consumer interest in them as well.
Well, we're going to take a little musical break, and we'll be right back and hear all about Atascadero Creek.
I heard tell of the miracles my blessed Savior does. He took a great big ball of fire.
You're listening to Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan here on KRCB. Thanks for tuning in. I should tell you that if you want to get updates about what's happening each week on Mouthful, you can become a fan on Facebook, just Mouthful, and I always post what's going on. And if there are links for information to websites, that sort of thing, I post those as well. It's a really efficient way to get information out there. In the studio with me, Steven Singer of Pizza Vino 707. And I don't even know if we said the name of your winery. Nice. Baker Lane Vineyards is the winery. We also have Eric Sussman, a well-known, well-respected winemaker of Radio Coteau. I'm going to ask you about that name, too, before we're done, and County Line. And then Bob Appleby of Atascadero Creek. So Atascadero Creek, I've heard that it's actually the tiniest bonded winery in California. Is that true?
I probably am. Yeah, I'm probably the smallest standalone winery. Uh-huh. There are other people that just make a few hundred cases.
No, but I mean standalone.
I'm standalone. I'm a bonded facility. Yeah.
And where are you located?
I'm right in Grayton. It's actually at my home on Ross Road. I was a cabinet maker there for 30 years, building furniture and cabinets. And when I started making wine in 89, I went to the county and they said, well, you're zoned for it. You can have a winery there. So,
wow.
You know, 2,000 case use permit, but I've never made more than about 500.
Yeah. And does the winery have a tasting room?
No.
So people can go to Pizza Vino and taste.
Yeah, my house is
there. Your house,
it wasn't going to work having a tasting room.
Absolutely. So. I think that's a wise move.
I've just primarily sold the restaurants and a few wine shops, and but it's nice to have a presence in a tasting room.
Yeah, I've always come across you in restaurants. I haven't seen you on retail shelves until walking past.
Yeah, a few places in the West County, a few wine shops and markets, but primarily I sell the restaurants.
And what varietals are you making?
I make an estate Pinot for my own vineyard, which is small, about 100 cases. Mm-hmm. And then I make usually one or two other single vineyard Pinots, which are all very small. They're like one-ton lots, so they're 50, 60 cases. Mm-hmm. I make about 100 cases of Zinfandel. I make some Syrah. And then on altering years, I make either Carignan, I make Primitivo, and Sangiovese, which I kind of alternate years on those mm-hmm. varietals. And then I make my Sauv Blanc as well mm-hmm. from Ken Ritchie's vineyard.
Uh-huh. Now, Primitivo, tell us about that. I've always thought, perhaps mistakenly, that Primitivo was Zinfandel in Italy.
Well, that's the story. Primitivo, okay. I guess genetically, is so close that the TTB, the feds say that you can call it either Zin or Primitivo.
Uh-huh.
But the old world clones have a different characteristic. They have a little different style and flavor to them. And there's not much of the old original clone planted around here, but I have access to some. And so in addition to my Zin, I made it last year. Mm-hmm. So next year I'll have Primitivo again. I make it every second or third year.
What are the different characteristics between Zin and Primitivo here in Sonoma County?
To me, it's just kind of a richer variety. It seems like it has a lot of depth. It doesn't have the pepper and spice that some of the California Zins have. Uh-huh. I think it's a result of taking that clone and bringing it over here. And 300 years it was brought over here by the monks that were doing the missions and mm-hmm. planning. And 300 years in California it's evolved into a different style. Although genetically, it's apparently the same thing.
Do you find it ripening at about the same time as Zinfandel?
My Zin is really late ripening, the vineyard that I use. And the Primitivo comes in a little before that. But my vineyard, where I get my Zinfandel, is dry farmed, and it's tough going out there. I mean, it doesn't get much help. It's old school farmed.
Where is it exactly?
My Zinfandel vineyard is in Windsor, just below Healdsburg on the east side of the freeway, just in the very top of Windsor on the east mm-hmm. side. And it was planted in 1948 by Joe DiMaggio's cousins, by the DiMaggio family. Uh-huh. And it's never been sprayed. It's never been irrigated. It gets nothing. They disc it twice a year and prune it. And then I go out there and thin it and pick it. But it's very low yield.
About how much?
There's about 4 acres, and I think the best I've ever got is 3 tons.
Wow.
Yeah, low yield.
Which is, 3 tons is about right for me. Mm-hmm. If it was any more, it would be too much for mm-hmm. me.
What do y'all's wines sell for? Let's start with Baker Lane Rosé.
Good question, actually. The Rosé is it's the kind of thing that different retailers and the restaurants have their prerogative on how they market up.
Let's say if we came to Pizzavino,
it'd be $15.
$15 for the bottle.
Yeah. $15 at retail. It's, we have the one of the policies or protocols in the wine collective is we sell retail wines to go, but if you drink that wine in the restaurant, the restaurant wine list price is the equivalent of the retail price plus a corkage in effect of $12.
Uh-huh.
So that means it's $27 to drink the rosé there, but the same thing applies to one of Eric's wines that we might have, where if you just add $12 to the retail price, it's a lot lower price to drink it in the restaurant than you would face with the kind of markup standards that most restaurants mm-hmm. use. So that's part of what we're trying to accomplish.
What does County Line Rosé sell for retail?
The retail price is about $18.
$18.
Yeah.
And what did you bring? You brought Zinfandel tonight,
I brought
right?
Zin. I realize now I should have brought a Sauv Blanc. I haven't made rosé
since
2006, so I'm out of rosé.
And what's the sort of price range of your wines?
My Sauv Blanc is $18, mm-hmm. yeah, retail. And my reds range from 25 to 32.
Mm-hmm. Are y'all being affected by, you hear this whole two-buck chuck phenomenon in the current economy? I've always wondered if that phenomenon has impacted people who really care about what they drink.
Yes.
It has, okay.
It's not so much two-buck chuck, but the You know, the interesting fact is that people are drinking more. Consumption in this economy has not declined.
You would think it had perhaps risen.
But yeah, right.
I think it actually has.
It has, actually. Yeah. But people are, as they say, they're drinking down. Mm-hmm. So that the price per bottle of what is being consumed in America is definitely going down. And it's not so much two-buck chuck as it is the inexpensive wines out of Australia and a lot of other sources of inexpensive wine, whether it's Chile or Argentina or parts of Europe where, you know, there isn't a big history of high quality or expensive wines, but they're in the import channels now.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's the yellowtail phenomenon, which not only hurt a lot of fine producers, but has made a very unfortunate impact on people's perception of Syrah.
Oh, really? Talk more about that.
Well, Syrah, for a long time, wasn't a terribly successful grape in California because it wasn't planted reliably in good places. Mm-hmm. And in the last 20 years, that's changed dramatically. There's been tremendous enthusiasm for planting it in correct places and winemakers making really wonderful wines for it because they're enthusiastic about the flavor potential. But the perception of high-quality Syrah-based wines in California started to suffer as a result of the perception that Syrah is not a delicious wine. It's the same as or a significant or a complex wine. It's quaffable, easy drinking stuff because that's a lot of what the Australians accomplished by having such great market penetration with inexpensive wines, Yellowtail being the most significant one. And Syrah and Shiraz from Australia are kind of like you're talking about with Primitivo and Zinfandel, they're more or less the same grape from a botanical standpoint. And, you know, the Syrah has never produced better wines than it is in California now. And it's one of the real sad things about the wine industry. There are producers that are making Syrahs. They're struggling to sell some of the best wines being made in the state now.
Yeah, it really seemed like a decade ago, it seemed like California Syrah was really going to take off, I thought. It seems like a really good bet, and I thought that the wines were really quite nice. I still do. I was surprised that one hasn't gone as, you know, people like you who planted it predicted. And part of the reason, I mean, we have to realize in this country, especially if you get away from, you know, the, for lack of a better word right now, the foodie culture, people are intimidated about ordering varietals they don't know how to pronounce. And Syrah seems like an easy hurdle. And so I thought, first of all, the wine is delicious and approachable and food friendly. And, you know, it's not Gruner Vettling or so. It's not going to intimidate
like
Americans. Right.
Which nobody knows how to say.
Yeah. So I was really surprised. Do you have any, can you see into the future? Any sense of what's going to happen?
You know, it seems like right now there's people that are committed to the Syrah mission, and then there's other folks that are kind of pulling back and because it's so hard to sell. And you know, when you look at the red varietals, you know, Cabernet is to a certain extent still king. Pinot Noir has really come a long way in the last few years. And Syrah falls between Pinot Noir and Cabernet in terms of just the structure. And so the you know, the press has been behind the grape. Our climate is almost, in many regards, at least here in on the North Coast, very well suited for the grape because Syrah has a little bit thicker skin than Pinot. So when you get into some warmer spots, especially in these cooler appellations, the grape can hold up to the heat better as opposed to starting to dehydrate when we get a lot of heat just before harvest sometimes. So I think, you know, I think there's a future for it. But as with Stephen was saying too, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of Syrah planted in places that it probably shouldn't have been planted. And now I think people are either grafting over or, you know, focusing on the spots that are good for Syrah. So I think the best sites will continue to be part of the picture. And some, maybe the weaker sites will fall out and get grafted over to something else.
Now, where does Syrah want to be? Does it want to be in a cooler climate?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. I mean, but it can grow. You know, you have cool climate expressions out here in the West County, but it gets to a point where it is a late season varietal. I mean, we have Syrah that sometimes picks, as does Stevens Vineyard, you know, late October, early November. And in a vintage like 09, it gets really, it's really risky at that point because the storms start to come in. And there's some great Syrah grown in Napa too, which is a warmer climate. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty versatile. But as you get to the warmer Appalachians with the Syrah grape, as with any grape, you start to lose a sense of place because a lot of the nuances are lost because the fruit starts to dominate some of the spice.
Interesting. Really interesting. I remember Gary Farrell saying to me quite a number of years ago, pay attention to cool weather, cool climate Syrah in California.
That's the best, it's the best place to grow it, as far as I am concerned. And it also likes good drainage. My favorite Syrahs are all sloped vineyards. That seems to, that's where you get the spice and the pepper. The flat stuff and the Central Valley stuff they've been growing is rather nondescript. It's more like the Australian stuff. It doesn't have the character that we get out here.
Somebody once said to me, what really pleased me is they described my wine as having a lot of detail. And I think
that's a nice thing.
Yeah, it is. And I think the detail comes when the flavor accumulation is slower and more gradual. That you pick up a lot of flavor, and as Eric says, you retain a more of a sense of sight when the flavors ripen and collect gradually. It's an interesting kind of metaphor, but I think it actually is apt.
Yeah. We're going to take another musical break and be back and talk about one of my favorite subjects.
I'm a drunken-hearted man. My life's been so miserable.
There's so much to talk about. One thing we should say, the Wine Collective, which is really an opportunity to both taste and then buy retail wines of small producers in Western Sonoma County, is made up not only of Baker Lane Vineyards, Atascadero Creek, and Radio Coteau, along with County Line, the three that are represented here today, but we have three others.
We've also got the wines of a wonderful artisan winemaker, Fred Scher, who's been making wonderful wines.
Fred, yes.
Yeah, I know. Fabulous. I know Fred. He's a big fan of yours too.
I'm a huge fan of his. I remember when he was making wines at Dehlinger.
Yeah, he wanted to be here, but he had a scout commitment tonight.
We'll get him here another time.
And there's a young winemaker whose name is Justin Lantanzio, and he has a label called Lantanzio Family Vineyards. Justin's also the proprietor of the collective winemaking facility where our wines are produced along with about 15 other small producers. It's called Vinify, which is in Santa Rosa, a real state-of-the-art place. And then we have the wines of Les Claypool. Claypool Cellars, who's actually one of our investors at Pizza Vino as well.
And he's doing, what is it, Pachyderm Purple?
Well, he has a Pinot that's called Purple Pachyderm.
That's right, okay.
And I think I noticed this year, we were bottling the same day, he produced a rosé.
Oh, he did?
From 2009. And he's even got some kind of Grenache Syrah Mourvedre blend that, and I don't know where he got that fruit, but so that's a wine I think they made last fall, and I don't know when that's going to be in the supply chain.
And Les Claypool, of course, of Primus, and Les Claypool of the Frog Brigade. If you watch South Park, you know Les Claypool. It was so tempting. I was going to play all Les Claypool music tonight, but I thought, you know, that's just too obvious. I play him on my other show, Red Shoes Rodeo. It's one of the fun things about Sonoma County. The next thing you know, Tom Waits is going to be making wine.
He likes the restaurant. I know that.
Yeah. Let's talk about Pinot Noir. I promised we were going to talk about one of my favorite subjects. Pinot Noir has long been a favorite subject of mine. So you all make it. All three of you make it.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Eric, let's start with you, because I think you might have a bottle sitting here.
Yeah, I brought the 2007 Radio Coteau La Neblina Pinot Noir, and it's coming from vineyards that are in western Sonoma County. This bottling is actually, there was two vineyard sources, one in Sebastopol and one up in Annapolis, which is...
Annapolis.
Yeah, just below the Mendocino border. And, you know, Pinot Noir is a grape that really captures a sense of place. And when the varietal is planted on different sites, different soil types, in different microclimates, you get lots of different characters and personality in the wine. I mean, the winemaker obviously can influence the character of the wine, but here at Radio Coteau, we're essentially non-interventionalists. We're not adding anything to the wine outside a little bit of sulfur during the aging process. We choose, you know, barrels to put the wine in, but we're really trying to capture an expression of place and time. And so when we're working in the vineyards, we're trying to get the best raw materials we can. We bring the grapes into the winery, and then we really try to step back. And I think Pinot Noir is a vehicle. Often people say it's a window, you know, into the site. So in different years, it will express differently, but it really captures the sense of place, often more so than other varietals.
How would you describe Pinot Noir to someone who had never tasted it?
Well, I mean, it can take on a lot of different, you know, there's a lot of different expressions of Pinot Noir. I mean, the ultimate expression is red Burgundy. And I mean, Burgundy is a very, you know, they've been making wine in Burgundy for forever, right?
Yeah.
So, not sure how long ever is, but it's a long time. And, you know, I spent some time actually living and working in Burgundy, and that's where I first started to learn about Pinot Noir. And then I came back to California and actually spent 4 years working at Dehlinger Winery after Fred Scherer had actually left.
Okay.
And so, and that's a great site. Where it's a state, and once again, you're getting, you know, a Rushmore Valley appellation. We have, you know, warm days sometimes and cool nights, and we often get an expression of lots of red fruits, sometimes black fruits, but we also we get a sense of the soil tones. Mm-hmm. And so here in, you know, western Sonoma County, I think Pinot Noir is pretty well suited to the climate and the soils, and they're wines with, they can be, you know, there can be very ripe expressions, and there can be very elegant expressions. Mm-hmm. And it's a function of where the sites are and also when the grapes are picked. And lately it seems like more people are moving further, closer to the coast. Because as I was explaining earlier, I mean, Pinot Noir is a thin-skinned grape, and when it's exposed to too much heat, it starts to lose that sense of place. Mm-hmm. So it's fragile, and it's very temperamental, not only in the vineyard, but also in the cellar. So it can be very light and elegant, also very structured and full-bodied.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that Pinot Noir has to me that no other wine has, is something that I call, for lack of a better term, the Pinot thing. If I'm being particularly perverse, I'll call it Pinescence, a term I want credit for coining. It's a delicacy, something I find truly intoxicating, and this is before it ever gets into your mouth, this intoxicating delicacy that if it's there, it is absolutely unmistakable. And if it's not there, people say, what are you talking about? It's my favorite quality in any wine. It's just when it's there, it's like there's a reason for living. It's slightly erotic. It's beautiful. It's ephemeral.
It's erotic and exotic. I mean,
yeah, it's both.
You listen to a lot of the descriptors of some of the great old descriptions, you know, especially people like Michael Broadbent and others who've written about wine, and it's almost the most sensual set of descriptors. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the reasons why Pinot Noir has evolved so dramatically in California is people wanted to try and make that kind of wine. They wanted to emulate Burgundy because everybody's you respect Bordeaux, you respect Cabernet, but you love Pinot Noir when it's great. And it's because it's so elusive. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Pinot wasn't planted in the right place, and the mm-hmm. results were fairly humdrum for a long time. Yeah. But, you know, people even before Eric, but Eric really epitomizes what is good about a lot of the best winemaking around Pinot Noir in particular is the whole notion of wine growing.
Mm-hmm. Where absolutely.
You're not just growing grapes, but mm-hmm. you're actually growing the flavor of the wine in the vineyard and understanding causation and how your vineyard techniques result in certain flavors, or certain sites have certain flavors you want to try and preserve and nurture. And that level of insight is really accumulating dramatically in winemaking in general in California, but especially in this area where a lot of these cooler sites are producing fantastically nuanced wines.
So now, since we're talking about Pinot Noir, let's pop some open. Let's try some. And Eric, could you relate to what I said at all?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I was going to say, you know, when I worked in France, the Burgundians, you know, there's a lot of, you know, rivalry between Bordeaux and Burgundy. But if you would ask, you know, a French person, what's the difference? Often I would hear, you know, Bordeaux is a wine for the intellect and Burgundy is a wine for the soul, you know, and I think it's kind of in line with what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's very, very sensual. In fact, if you want to see, it's the first one I fell in love with, probably the first and the last one I actually fell in love with. And when I was completely enamored of it, that book, The Heartbreak Grape, came out. And I found that book on a shelf in Berkeley before anyone was talking about it. And it's like, what? Someone else thinks this? And so I wrote an article that has since appeared in about 5 different publications. And if you want to see sort of my exuberance about Pinot Noir at its absolute silliest, you can go to my website, michellenajordan.com, and I think it's just articles. I think if you click on articles, and it's called Sex in a Single Grape. And I actually had an absolute blast writing it. And even though I'll go back and I'll blush a little bit and think, I can't believe I said that, I still mean every bit of it.
Mm. So this is the, like I said, the 2007 La Neblina by Radio Coteau. And La Neblina means the fog in Spanish, and it's kind of a tribute to the fog that is such a critical element, mm-hmm. climatic element in Western Sonoma County. You know, we get these warm days, but at night, you know, via the Petaluma Gap, we get a lot of fog intrusion that cools down the air. And often in the summer, you know, kind of weather patterns, the fog will stay in the Rush River Valley or kind of Sebastopol area, Sonoma Coast area, until about 11 or so, and start burning off. And so this wine is kind of a tribute to that, you mm-hmm. know, that cool climate expression. And in this bottle, we actually use 15% whole cluster, which is kind of an, mm-hmm. you know, an interesting element. It brings a spicy component, and we're actually just taking the entire grape and putting it in the vat before we actually add the destemmed fruit on top.
Yeah, there's a real spicy element that I'm trying to identify. It'll come to me in a second. But, you know, we could go on for 2 hours. Bob, I really want you to open up. I don't want to not taste one of your wines. So how about we? Which would you rather we tasted, the Pinot or the Zin? You already know my choice.
Well, you want the Pinot, and it's your show, so I guess we'll open the Pinot.
I have a great respect and affection for Zinfandel as well. I don't, you know.
It doesn't have to be either or. It's one of the pleasures
right.
of...
Yes.
There's room for everything.
As Americans, we are, by definition, pretty eclectic in our taste, and we have a lot of wine choices that help sustain that.
This Radio Coteau, La Neblina, obviously, we were just talking about fog, I think, when we took a musical break. Obviously, I love the name, and I love the wine. It makes me want to eat duck.
Mm.
It makes me want to eat rare duck breast.
Rare duck breast.
Actually, this would also go really well, I think, with the Gleason Ranch goat breast I've been experimenting with lately.
Mm.
I think it would go really nicely.
Nice.
You should have brought
him.
Some.
I should have. I should have next time.
We'll just have it here. Well, this is my estate Pinot. This is the Railroad Vineyard from the Green Valley. The vineyard is right along Atascadero Creek. And it's, we're real low down there, which is like Eric saying, was saying earlier, the, it's the fog that this, that the Pinot really loves. And where I am, it's cold. Highway 116 is a quarter mile from my vineyard and house, but it's about 200 feet higher. And from my house up to Highway 116 is sometimes 10 degrees warmer when you go up the hill. And so my place is often foggy late in the morning, and Pinot just loves that. You know, I mean, it's what it really needs. And the vineyard here, this is the Railroad Vineyard. About 15 years ago, I bought about a half a mile of the old railroad right away. There was a rail spur behind my property. And 9 years ago, I planted a vineyard out there. And so it's virtually no soil. There's 2 feet of rocks. And so it's basically, it was really difficult getting them, the stakes in. But it's growing in rocks, so the drainage is good.
Well, let's try that puppy.
And it has a very, it's very Burgundian in style. It's very, has a lot of structure. It's high mineral. I've had writers that reviewed it say, in a blind tasting, they would confuse it. They could be fooled into thinking it was a French Burgundy.
French Burgundy. Yeah. How do you all feel about alcohol levels?
Well, I think there's a big shift now towards, you know, wines with a little more restraint, lower alcohol. And for many years, there was this trend towards, you know, picking riper. And it's challenging. I mean, you need not only, you know, to get a lower alcohol, you not only need to have a cooler site, but, you know, the vintage also has to cooperate, you know, and there's so many factors in the vineyard that would affect, you know, the potential alcohol, which is directly related to the actual sugar accumulation in the grape. But I mean, one of the biggest challenges that I have in California is actually making wines with lower alcohol. And if you were to compare that to the challenges that they say have in Burgundy, it's actually, it's the rains, you know, it's the not having enough ripeness. So it's almost the opposite challenge. You know, we have potentially too much heat here, and there they could have, you know, rain or just cool weather that would destroy a vintage.
They hear that since the 1970s, California, if I have the statistics correct, California has average temperatures have increased, what, 1.5 degrees or something? Something like that. And it's resulted in a 17% increase in alcohol levels. This was like two or three years ago.
Part of that is due to Al Gore, no doubt. But, but part of it is also a stylistic sort of trends.
Trends for when they pick. For
I mean, even in a cooler site, you can shoot for higher alcohols if you decide to shoot for riper fruit. But I think that the trend that Eric is talking about is a really welcome one. And it's also connected with people figuring out where to plant the right thing. That accumulated understanding is really something we're benefiting from now.
I'm finding that wines with a higher alcohol level, especially once you get over about 14.6 and you start going up beyond that, they're not that food friendly.
They're pretty ponderous.
Yeah.
And they also don't tend to age as gracefully. You know, they can be really sexy and appealing on release, but, you know, the riper wines tend to get clumsy as they age. So, but as you said, I mean, the main thing is that wine is food and you need wines that pair well with food.
Yeah.
And the wines with lower alcohol accompany the foods better.
They stay fresher in your mouth.
And some varietals respond much better to lower alcohols. Pinot is so delicate that if the alcohol gets up past, you know, low 14s, you lose the delicateness
of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas Zin can take more.
Zin can handle more
alcohol. But Pinot is best made at lower to moderate alcohol levels.
I agree. Tell us about your Pinot, Stephen. We don't have that tonight. We have your Syrah.
We
only have like 3 minutes left.
Yes. Okay. Well, quickly, our Pinot principally is sourced from a vineyard that's just down the road from us on Baker Lane. Baker Lane is actually the name of my winery, but it's actually the name of my road and where our fruit is sourced from, either my own vineyard or this other vineyard called the Raimondo Vineyard.
And you can see it out your window, right?
Just about. It's about a quarter of a mile.
It's beautiful.
Quarter of a mile. That's actually a different vineyard.
Oh, that is, okay.
This is another vineyard that is right
just
on
beyond,
Baker Lane.
Oh, okay.
Before you get to my property. And we were able to take over that vineyard from the ground up. So we have a real good relationship with the owners of the vineyard who are allowing us to farm it kind of to our specifications. And I was intrigued by the vineyard long before I knew we could get the fruit from it. And I was intrigued in particular because as we're learning more and more about how to produce the wines we want to make, we realize that it all kind of begins and ends in the vineyard. And having the opportunity to kind of fully farm and manage with the fantastic assistance of my vineyard manager, Greg Adams, you know, the fruit that we're producing is really elevated the potential that we have for all the wines that we're making.
You know, and on that note, we have to start wrapping things up. It went so fast. Is there information about the Wine Collective on the website?
Yes, there is. Pizzavino.com. Pizzavino707.com.
Pizzavino707. Of course, the restaurant is located on the town square.
In Sebastopol,
which means it's across McKinley from Whole Foods.
Exactly.
There's the big parking lot, the fountain, that sort of thing. What are your hours?
We're presently open Wednesday through Sunday. We serve lunch and have continuous service Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah, but you end too early for me to go there after mouthful.
We're going to work on that. I mean, we usually are served until 9 Wednesday and Thursday till 10 on Fridays and Saturdays, and at least for the moment, just until 8 on Sundays. We'll see what kind of lobbying effort.
Well, I think we should do an after mouthful at Pizzavino, and then anyone who's been listening to the show, wants to hang out, that sort of thing, can just meet me. You know, I've always wanted to do this, and I haven't found, you know,
what is that?
The right
what
place
is
yet.
That flash mob at Pizzavino? Have you ever heard of that idea of a flash mob?
Flash mob?
You just tell people to show up.
Oh, show up!
And it's a Twitter deal.
Twitter, yeah, it's like Flash Posse, which was featured on Law and Order the other night. Bob Appleby of Atascadero Creek, I love your wines. I'm bummed with you. I'll have to taste your Zinfandel sometime soon. You have a website?
I do, atascaderocreek.com.
There you go. Try the Sauvignon Blanc. It's fabulous. I know that Radio Coteau has a website. I visit there frequently.
Yeah, it's radiocoteau.com.
What about County Line?
We do have a website for County Line,
you
too.
You do? Okay.
Yeah.
And, of course, these wines, as well as Fred Scherer, Claypool Cellars, and Lantenzio Family Vineyards, all available retail at Pizzavino 707. And that wraps it up for another yummy episode of Mouthful, Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. Have a great week, and meet me back here next Sunday at 7 on KRCB. And thanks to Lawrence, our engineer.
Just saying.